Tonight we're going to discuss values with a humanist and clergy from many of the world's religions. Here tonight are Reverend Dr. Charles Wolfe from the Plymouth Congregational Church in Madison, Robert Park of the Humanist Union of Madison, Amir and Imam Salih Irshan from the Dawah Circle Muslim Mosque in Madison, and by phone we're joined by Rabbi Shay Taub of the Lubavitch of Wisconsin, and also by phone is Reverend Prakash Shakti from the Integral Yoga Institute of Virginia. She's familiar with Hinduism and Buddhism. Welcome all. Values. Most people claim to have them. Why are there so many points of view, then, on any given issue? Our problem is largely one of language. The word values, in terms of moral beliefs and attitudes, has two distinctive meanings: personal preferences and objective principles. Preferences and principles are opposites. Preferences are subjective, while principles are objective. Values that are preferences are something to have, but values that are principles are something to be. This confusion of the use of the word in the context of the moral beliefs is not surprising given the relatively short term it's been in use in that sense. 100 years ago, for reasons of his own, with which we needn't concern ourselves here, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche began to speak of values in a new way. He used values not as a verb, meaning to value or esteem something, nor as a noun, meaning the measure of something, like the value of money or property. He used it in the plural, meaning the moral beliefs and attitudes of society. Objective values, principles or virtues, transcend time and culture. They include but are not limited to honesty, compassion, responsibility, respect, and consideration of others. Let's begin the discussion there. Are these in fact universal virtues? Are they found in all the traditions represented here tonight?
Well, I would say that...
This is Sally.
This is Sally. I would say that as far as honesty and justice and truth, I believe that those are probably pretty universal principles. The difficulty, I think, for humankind is finding the right mode for understanding those things, and then finding the right nexus to place ourselves in relation to those things. So generally, I think that's where the struggle of the humankind is the strongest, is trying to figure out values and morals and ethics for ourselves. And then more difficult than that is to how to apply those to a social atmosphere, where the values may be then limited or regulated. And if that becomes the case, then, of course, we want to... we want to try to keep freedoms, but in the face of freedoms for all, sometimes limitations have to be there to keep parameters so that we can maintain a social well-being. And I think that that frame of of measure is what human beings have a hard time with. So do we open up the floodgates and let everything be acceptable, or how do we then manage these parameters so that everybody can still have an equal try at gaining whatever justice out of the system? So I think that's the thing, because in the end, we talk about different faith traditions and things like that. Each one more than likely has a good intention in it, but then each one has a different modality for these, setting these limitations, and then we all have not just opinions, but we all have different things that we hold on to, and convictions, and then a hierarchy. So mine has to be higher than the other one, or else I'm being ruled by this or that. So this is the difficult part, I think, is because in order to have something limit you, it should be above you, And this is, for myself as a Muslim, this is where I find freedom to be having a higher power that has given limitations. I simply just submit to those limitations. Okay. And then when I need access for finding out what they are, I go to the revelation that's been given. And so therefore, I have a system.
Okay.
So that's kind of my...
Reverend, do you find that the values that we listed here are rather universal?
I think they are, and I'm interested in pursuing this a little bit, because in the time that Sally and I spent before the program just visiting with one another a little bit, I haven't found any points of conflict with right. him, any points where our values are don't seem quite similar. So
that's supposed to be the whole idea this evening.
So are we going to wrap the program up here then? So I'm interested in pursuing that a little bit,
sure.
and seeing where those limitations are that you've spoken of.
Sure. Well, can we first go around and hear from sure. all the participants here? We have a humanist here, Bob. Right. Would you like to give us some idea?
I think these are pretty general virtues that just about everybody can agree on, and humanists certainly have moral values that are in accord with these as well.
And Prakash, are you there in Virginia?
Yes, I am here too.
Okay, we can hardly hear you also. Perhaps our engineer can do something about that. Rabbi, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Oh, good. Well, are these principles, are these universal as far as you're concerned?
Universal values that you mentioned are absolutely, as we're referring to them, universal.
Yeah.
Whether you believe that it's an imperative based on revelation, or you believe that you've arrived upon it through trial and error, or through... I was just considering, but I'm sorry, I missed the name of the first speaker. I believe was a Muslim.
Salih.
Salih. So Salih mentioned the idea of, to be limited, there must be, and I'm sure the humanist will take exception. I'll give him a chance to say. I'm sorry, I don't want to call him the humanist. His name again, I'm sorry?
It's Bob.
Bob. Okay, so Salih said that to be limited, one must feel, what right do I have to be limited by something that's not above me? And so there has to be some sort of a submission to a higher power. That's where Salih and I definitely agree, that there has to be a supplication, a surrender to something greater than us that has the right to limit us and to impose, yes, to impose values and even to compel us to accept morality even when it's not convenient or it's a personal impracticality, and to surrender ourselves to a higher will, to a higher vision. I'm sure Bob will agree with that in his own words.
I disagree.
That's what Salih said that really resonated with me.
Okay. Let's give Bob a moment here. I think he's got a good reason.
I think as a humanist, I would see the source of these kind of virtues and values as coming not from a higher power, but from human experience. As we grow in our families and as we relate to others in our community, we learn from our parents and from our other surroundings what is destructive to relationships and what is positive in relationships. I think that we all have common human experiences from which we develop a sense of what's right and wrong and what's good and bad, and develop our own personal consciences. And it is, in fact, this conscience we develop as individual human beings that we use to evaluate the teachings we hear from religions that we are raised in, or from our parents if they're not religious.
Prakash, are you? Can you hear us yet?
Well, I can hear you just fine.
Good. Yeah, we can hear you now too. Good. So, how do you feel about these so far universal virtues? Are they found throughout the Eastern philosophies also?
Yes, I think that the basic values are the same throughout all the different philosophies. And in fact, as Bob was saying, through the human experience, whether we are answering to God, or if we want to say that's a higher power, or if we want to say it's our conscience, whatever that is, the basic values run through all the different world religions, and really
Okay, well, that sounds like we're unified on that. Now we've got the system down. What's the methodology? Is there a particular method by which we should apply these virtues? I mean, we've got a handful of virtues here. Now, what do we do? We've got action we want to take in our life. Now, we filter our actions through these virtues, and what direction we send them.
I can say, for as far as my again, this is Sally speaking. As far as my own personal, like, spiritual journey in life, I came to a point where I realized that I wanted to recognize the Creator, and I wanted to know a way to worship the Creator that would be a pleasing to Him. So, and when I make the reference, if I say Him or He or it, His, I don't mean to give a gender to God, or to Allah or the Creator, but it's just a way of making reference. So, but basically, in wanting to do that, I said to myself, well, how do I pray? And at that point, up to that point, what I would do normally was just recognize, you know, whatever good thing I liked in creation, and then just say, hey, thanks, Creator, for this nice thing you've done. But what I found was, like, I felt like that was a little bit too easy on myself, just as, you know, kind of taking things to my own advantage, and not actually giving anything from myself to show that I was actually thankful for those good things that were around me. I'm not talking about just a nice, fresh, brisk walk in the park or something like that, you know. So while I was taking the time to enjoy that walk in the park, I didn't take time to actually, you know, do something to show God or the Creator that I really enjoyed being able to have this life. So it brought me to a point of realizing I needed to learn a form of prayer. So for, you know, that brought me to learn the form of prayer in Islam. And that gave me a system, okay? It gave me, and again, it's not a ritual. It has a pattern to it and things of this nature, but the way that it started to take place in my life is in tune with all of what's in the cosmos, because the time of prayer is set by the sun, and, you know, these things change, you know, as far as the orbit of the sun and the earth and things. So it was taking on a pattern in my life that would allow for me to be in touch with that thing. So, you know, I think that having a path or having a pattern to follow helps a lot. So when you need to make a reference, you go back to that reference.
Well, how would you apply these virtues, though, in, say, your daily life? Aren't you actually working towards become a paramedic?
Exactly.
Well,
so I've been learning a lot of lessons in that as well, too.
So you're focusing your positive virtues towards the community.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing, too. Also, in being in paramedics, so you're experiencing a situation that not everybody gets to experience, because you come into a scene where there's trauma, you know, and sometimes life and death comes the situation. So now you're being trained to handle, come into a situation where there's life and death right in front of you. And this becomes one of the things that brings you, you know, to one of these most finite measures of the human experience. It's like life and death, you know. You know, my purpose there is to try to help this person in any way possible, to help to reduce their pain, to help to save their life if possible. But the thing that's also a lesson in this is that all of it is really out of your hand. You do what you're trained to do, but the end result is still God's decision. If that's the time when the soul is going to be taken from them, then it happens, okay, regardless of the medicine I have.
Reverend, how do you? Which direction in our social phenomenal world do you direct your virtues?
Well, I think for Christians, one cannot really speak about the Christian faith without speaking about the community. I mean, it is impossible, almost, to imagine practicing Christianity and maybe any religion on an island all by oneself. Mm. I mean, ethics almost become irrelevant if one is all by oneself. What is not legal and who is harmed?
Yeah.
And so one lives within the community. And it seems to me that the biblical understanding, I think this would be true of Old Testament as well as New Testament, that the community is seeing as all humanity ultimately. It is not only those of us who are practicing a particular religion, but it is also those who live among us.
So in other words, my brother and sister is just as much someplace in Afghanistan as they are here.
Exactly.
Okay. Robert?
I think that the key is how we relate to other people, and in particular the decision-making points when we are dealing with other people. That's where we put our values into play. And it's not necessarily people that we... it includes more than just the people we meet on a day-to-day basis. It includes the people that are involved in our society in other ways. It includes the way we relate to our government, for example. And if we were to take a couple of these virtues, for example, honesty and responsibility, a good example of where they would come into play is as we do our online Christmas shopping. And we know that we're supposed to report a sales tax on our state income tax. A lot of people forget to do that or don't even know that they're supposed to do that. But that's the honest thing to do as an honest taxpayer, and that's the responsible thing to do because we're responsible for maintaining our state government.
Okay. Chase?
I'm tempted to ask if you as a humanist, A, pay those state taxes, and secondly, if you actually do Christmas shopping.
Well, yes to both.
I'm interested to ask, is that the identity that you associate yourself with? Is that a taxpayer? Is your full... Does that sum up your whole existence?
Of course not. I'm a member of the community, and being a taxpayer is part of that. Being a member of the community, in this case, a member of the... a citizen of the state of Wisconsin.
Right. Okay. I'd like to hear from Shay, if we could. Shay, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So what do you feel about the direction in our phenomenal world about these virtues and how you apply them to... or which direction do you apply them?
You know, Judaism does not regard, to a certain extent, duties to one's fellow and duties to one's creator as two separate things.
Okay.
Really, although... of course, Jewish civil law is replete with good common sense, social justice, welfare. Nevertheless, we're told that these are divine writ and that we should embrace them as if they were super rational, as if we couldn't understand them. Because after all, we're not doing it out of being somehow duty-bound just as good rational folk. We're doing it because of revelation, because of a God who is the maker and who designed the world with a purpose. And if we want to use the world, that's our charge, that's our duty, to use the world, to be its stewards. If we want to use the world for the function for which it was designed, even though it's quite easy to use the world and our bodies and our relationships and our time and our money and misappropriate them for things that they weren't designed, but if we do want to use them for which they were designed, we really have to consult with the Maker and with His will. And so to us, you know, social obligations and social justice really is not so different than, let's say, the ritual aspects of Jewish life, the holidays, and that are of a completely super rational nature, like not mixing milk with meat.
Okay. Prakash, have you got some words from the East over there?
Wisdom from the East.
Just what direction?
Ultimately, yeah. Of course, we're citizens of the entire universe. We start with our own homes, and then move out into our immediate community, and hopefully as spiritual beings, we expand our community to think of our country, and then other countries and the whole world. So in spiritual life, the way we serve others and care about others and for others is vital. One of the things, one of the guidelines that is a fantastic thing to use every day, at least I find it a tremendous guideline, is to judge everything you, evaluate everything you do or are thinking of doing by saying, is it a benefit to someone, even a little benefit? And is it of harm to no one? It, the benefit doesn't have to be huge. It could be small. But is it of some benefit and of no harm? And if that's the case, do it. And this is a beautiful way, I think, to judge and make decisions for ourselves about how we're going to act, how we're going to proceed.
Well, I'm sitting with some pretty lofty thinkers here. the correct answer was the golden rule, which actually I think is what everybody's really come about saying. My little simple way of approaching it was just simply to think in terms of what's best for everybody in general, what's best for the community. Now, we've included God in some aspects and not included God, just simply dealt with a rational, reasonable approach to it. But we wind up coming out to focusing these applications or these principles on the community. And the benefit is what, ladies and gentlemen? Is there a long-term or short-term benefit? I mean, it's been my observation in the world that we live in is that existence is really sort of a duality. It's an ambiguity and a paradox is the rule, really, rather than the exception. Up and down, light and dark, good and evil. If this is the case, then virtues must have their reciprocals, too, like dishonesty, callousness, selfishness, obfuscation. And accordingly, the reciprocal of long-term concern for others would be the short-term selfish concern for ourselves. A main tenet of Buddhism is that life is suffering and that suffering is caused by desire. More recently, we have the adage, the desire for money is the root of all evil. Isn't then the origin of desire ego?
Now, Jim, if I could jump in here.
Surely.
I think by mentioning ego and desire as an inverse of virtue, you really set the scene for understanding what it really means to be committed to virtue. You see, the way we understand it, the way the Torah teaches, is that all of us are born with an innate animalistic nature. And it's not necessarily evil. A baby, when he's born, is completely animalistic. It's a survival mechanism. It's necessary. As we mature and we realize that we can't just be for ourselves, we can't just be ever seeking more pleasure and more fulfillment and more gratification, and we sort of grow out of that animalism. But how do we become transcendent beings? How do we stop being ego-driven? So the answer really is, what you mentioned before, calling it to the Golden Rule, we attribute this to a story of a prospective convert in the age of the Roman occupation when a prospective convert came to Hillel, the sage, and he told Hillel he wants to become Jewish. But I'll only do it if you can say, if you can tell me the entire Torah standing on one foot. Well, he had tried this already with another sage who became disgruntled with him and told him that it's preposterous, I cannot tell you the whole Torah on one foot. But Hillel, who was known for his patience and kindness, stood on one foot, and he told him, that which is hateful to you, do not do to others. All the rest is commentary, go forth and learn. This idea, that which is hateful to you, do not do unto others, as summing up the entire Torah, the classic question asked in the Hasidic text, how can you sum up the entire Torah as just that which is hateful to you, don't do to others? I mean, that sums up maybe our social obligations from one human to another, but how does that incorporate our duties to God, our dietary restrictions, our prayers, our faith, our rituals, things that are completely have nothing to do with just good common sense and the well-being of society? So The Hasidic masters explain, the whole point of our journey here on earth is to transcend this innate animalism, which you called ego. And how does one transcend the ego, the drives of the body, the sense of self? Very simple. If you can get along with another human being, if you can have empathy, or at least sympathy, to not do that which is hateful to you, to another, once you can overcome this basic survival mechanism of looking out for number one, and actually being open and vulnerable and giving to another human being, with whom, after all, I'm in competition, there's limited resources, and if he gets the last donut, then I can't eat the last donut. These are all physical, these are all products of being physically focused, or identifying ourselves as physical beings. I'm one body, he's another body. I'm in my place, so if he's sitting in my place, I can't sit in my place. If he gets the parking spot, I can't get the parking spot. Mm-hmm. And if you can surrender that, if you can actually come to the level of being gracious to another human being, what you've actually accomplished, you have transcended that basic animalism, you have diminished the ego, and now all of the rest of God's way is open to you, meaning all of the affairs that are completely spiritual, all of the most lofty and the most fleeting ideals that are so difficult to grasp. We don't grasp them head on. First, be a human being who can surrender his own ego and body identity, be gracious to another human being. If you can do that, then you can be a clear, transparent conduit to godliness. You can allow your ego to become transparent, and now you can actually become a receptacle to something higher than yourself.
So,
and that's why Hillel said that sums up or encapsulates the entire Torah.
Okay, so that actually then is the benefit also. It's not just a matter of being kind and generous. It's a matter of having some benefit that comes back to you in a rather spiritual fashion.
But it's not about personal benefit.
Well,
it's okay. About clearing the way for godliness by at least removing the obstruction of your own ego. Okay. Your ego is an obstruction for God to manifest in this world. And if you can clear your ego and make your will his will, what you've done is you've cleared a pocket of light in this world. It's really an altruistic aim.
Okay. Sally, do you have anything from the Quran?
Yeah. I think the, first of all, we talk about the method or the path or the way to do to implement the virtues and things. And then before I started to comment on worship or turning to God, the reason why the prayer was so substantial for me in that practice was that in the prayer itself, in the very the best part of the prayer, we can say, is when your face and your hands and everything is on the ground, you're before your Creator, and in that position you say in Arabic Subhana Rabbi Allah, which means glory to the Lord Most High. So here you are as the created human being on the floor before God the Most High, and you're recognizing yourself in that position. So selflessness is at the core of this thing. And the origin of selfishness, I believe, is pride or arrogance. So practicing a life or activating a life practice of self-reform and doing away with selfishness, recognizing it in ourselves as human beings. Here we are with these traits. What are they? Now we have to learn to manage them. There's a really famous analogy that talks about the heart. There's lots of references that are made about the heart, because you talk about the heart with the soul, you talk about the heart with the spirit, you talk about the heart in a lot of different references. So the analogy was that the heart is an arena for this ego and for the soul. And the practice that goes on between them is that the ego needs to be put in a manageable position so that the soul can have its connection with its Creator. Now, you mentioned the Golden Rule, and I think that the Golden Rule is mentioned really along the through all the mainstream,
all like, the scriptures, yeah,
through the Torah, through the Injil, and through the Quran. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has known and have said that not one of you will believe until he desires for his brother what he desires for himself, which is essentially summing up this thing. None of you will believe. You won't have a true faith.
You won't be a real believer unless you...
I mean, you won't have look out for the other. Yeah, even your practice will be... It won't be right until you look out for your brother.
Muddied.
With what you want for yourself.
Charles, you got anything from Mark?
From Mark?
Well, that's the only one I knew of.
Sure. You have the great commandment when Jesus is asked which... what is the most important commandment? And answers that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself.
Okay.
Which is interesting to talk about loving your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
Which does not say that you have no ego, mm-hmm. but that you allow your ego to include your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
so that. You know, if you do not love yourself, then you can love your neighbor as the way you love yourself very easily, in the same kind of hateful ways that you treat yourself, perhaps. But surely that's not what Jesus intended. What he was talking about, as I would understand it, is caring for your neighbor with the same kind of care that you would wish to give to yourself, or to have your neighbor give to you.
Robert, Bob?
Well, of course, we humanists have no holy books or scriptures, so that means all the inspirational writings of humankind are open to us to read and find meaning in, as our own reasoning leads us to believe. I think the golden rule is good as far as it goes. It's interesting to note that the Ethical Humanist Society of Greater Chicago has for their Sunday school the Golden Rule Sunday School. That's what they call it. I think, as a humanist, I believe in love and compassion in human relations. And I think the Golden Rule doesn't necessarily cover all situations and how you would relate to other people. We live in a society that has a lot of influences that are not what we would regard as helping people to become the best that they can be. We have materialism, for example. And what if your children are interested in getting certain video games or something? Does the golden rule mean that I should give my brother these video games and he'll give me video games and we'll spend all our time doing video games? Does it mean
trade your best baseball card
or baseball cards? What if we want a fur coat made out of baby seal fur, and we participate in this kind of exchange, and it becomes a fad, and all the baby seals are killed off because all these people are giving each other baby seal fur coats.
Right.
Obviously, the golden rule has to have some sort of deeper guidance behind it.
And I would answer that that's why Jesus says, first of all, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength.
Yeah. Well, I would say that that's why Revelation is there, you know, in general. Yeah.
And as a humanist, I would say humans are basically good, and they develop as they grow under the influences and examples that they see. And if these influences around them are good, they will develop into loving people without having to be taught any particular scripture.
Prakash, are we missing something like karma in here? Is there a stage where we can bring karma into this?
A stage where we bring karma into it. Well, mm-hmm. first of all, I don't think we're missing anything.
Okay.
I think all of this is fantastic. I'm really appreciating everything that all the different people are bringing to this discussion from different ways of thought and different traditions and religions. I love it because I'm an interfaith person. I love to hear about the different approaches and enhance my own spiritual life that way. And I think that's the greatness of dialogues like this. But if you want to know about karma, Karma, of course, is very misunderstood. Karma simply means that for every action, there's a reaction. And so in the Eastern thinking with karma, the energy you put out there or the action that you put out there is eventually going to come back to you. I personally like to think that we can be motivated by something higher than just that kind of fear. If I do something bad's going to happen to me. Or if I do something good, ooh, I'm going to get something good too. I'd like to think that our motivations are deeper and something more lovely than that. But anyway, with karma, yes, if you are kind to others, that kindness will come back to you. Maybe not immediately, but at some point. You could say it's... I wouldn't equate the law of karma with the golden rule exactly, but... yes, whatever you do will come back to you. So if you're mean and nasty at some point in your life, that same kind of nastiness is going to come back, and kindness will come back to you. A great teacher, Swami Satchidananda, used to say, the selfless person is the most selfish person, because he or she knows that by giving completely to others, all good will come back. And also that by giving completely to others, great joy will come to you. Even if someone is not giving something to you, there's a tremendous joy, a profound joy, and for those who believe in this way, a profound connection with God that comes through our selflessness, our giving of ourselves to others.
Well, I'm sort of fond of little, simple little stories, and I'm thinking in terms of little Johnny who's playing with his toys, and his sister wants to play with him, and he won't share. So his father comes in and says, Johnny, share with your sister Sue. And he does so only because he's compelled to, but within a few minutes he doesn't realize it, but he's enjoying himself much more. He's bonding with his sister, he's having more fun with the toys than he would have alone, and there's a lesson to be learned there, because he's raised his consciousness, and he's having more fun than had he been just by himself and hoarding the toys himself. Unfortunately, his father doesn't come in and say to him, I see you're having more fun. So that lesson is often lost. And when Johnny grows up, he forgets that. And he goes back to the hoarding mentality he had before. We've got a number of traits here, both positive and reciprocal negatives. Are there any ways we can use these traits to identify, say, in a political situation or in a business situation? If we have people who are using values and applying them in their course of their lives, are there any way we can look at them and determine whether these people are people we should be confident in, put our confidence in and trust, or reciprocally, are there traits that we should watch for or contest for that would warn us to beware of some people?
Well, she was talking about the karma concept.
Mm-hmm.
Something that came to my mind is the justice that will be had no matter what, kind of a thing. One of the things that's really misunderstood by Islam a lot of times is the whole idea of Sharia law. And, you know, it's always talked about as this really rigid law system and things. The way that I've understood it is, as far as the way of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is a way of mercy, in fact, more so than policing. So in that way, There were as many times when people would come to him and even confess certain things, and he'd turn away from them, walk away, let them be with mercy, you know. So, but it seems, though, that the human wants to, you know, implement certain elements of justice, the measures that they think are just, and sometimes miss the mark. The beautiful thing is to be able to have a system that that allows for people even to get away with doing something wrong sometimes, but knowing ultimately that a justice is going to come upon them. So like in Islam, we do believe in a hereafter. And then we believe that if they're not, if something's not taken care of in this world, you know, if they do an injustice to other people, if it's not taken care of in this world, if they're not punished in this world or something like that, then in the hereafter they will be. Somehow they'll face that thing. So that kind of gives me a little bit of, it lets me relax a little bit because I see good and bad in the world. Now, the other thing is that we believe that the Creator created all of reality. So all of reality that has come already, all of reality that we're in right now, and every part of reality that will come, good and bad. So it again gives you, as the human being, or as the Creator, or the not the Creator, but the created, in this unraveling life, it gives me the opportunity to sit back and say, this is out of my control. You know, a good thing's happening or a bad thing's happening. Again, this is a lot of times relative. It's our perspective of the situation. But if we take us two or three steps back, if we had the ability to, and we look at the situation, there's actually good and bad in almost everything. So it pans out somehow as a balance, a harmonious balance. The difficulty is, though, when we are the ones experiencing right in front of us what is perceived to be the bad thing.
Do you see any traits that we could use as measurements for situations or individuals? Politicians, for example. I'm thinking, like, even Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's a public figure. I suppose we could kind of analyze him a little.
I mean, in that, I'm sorry to jump right back in, but with Bush, you know, I think for the most part, most of America probably sees Bush not to be the most positive figure in some respect or another. If it's warfare, if it's just his intelligence. But, so, or you could say Hitler. You have that written down on the notes that we have here in front of us. That's usually, in a lot of times in the mainstream media, that's usually the, like, one of the gauges that's used for a bad guy. Okay? So, if that's the case, you can take these people and you can say, okay, who were they? I would say even Genghis Khan. Because Genghis Khan came in and wiped out the Muslims in the area of Iraq a long time ago. And when he did that, the people brought a Quran to him and said, what should we do with these? This is their holy book. He said, destroy it. Because if they had lived by it, then I wouldn't have been able to come here and be the scourge to these people. So here's this really bad thing that happened. But what happened a generation or two after that is that the sons and daughters of that Mongolian leader became the leaders of Islam.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's some type of harmony that ended up happening.
Charles, you look like you had something you want to say over there.
Well, we're kind of caught up in the paradoxical nature of good and evil, I guess. Yeah,
yeah, and I was trying to get a little more to the today, the world today. What we can do for ourselves and for the rest of the community by, I suppose, initially measuring, calculating by using traits of personalities and situations in order to make appropriate judgments.
Well, I personally have found that it's important to me to resist some of the evils that I see in front of me. I have, for example, protested the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. It has not done any good that I have been able to perceive particularly, but at least it reminds me who I am, and that may be the best thing that I can do at this point, is not to forget who I am, not to allow myself to be lost in the kind of rush toward a desire for some kind of retaliation in response to 9/11, for example.
Well, Robert?
Well, we certainly have a lot of conflicts with good and bad sides to them. And I was involved in organizing an interfaith peace conference before Bush invaded Iraq. Prayer Unitarian Universalist Society became the first congregation to sponsor, and the Quakers joined us, and we ended up with 13 different faith-based groups sponsoring this conference, which was held in November of 2002 at the Blessed Sacrament Church. And I think it's hard to tell what the influences of that kind of thing is in the long term, because it certainly played a part in raising consciousness among a lot of people, even though there weren't enough people with enough power to prevent that war from happening. Tammy Baldwin spoke at that. I was thinking when you were talking, Jim, about compassion, how we can apply compassion in the political sense. And one of her areas of great interest is healthcare. And here in America, we're one of the few countries that doesn't provide basic universal health care for the public as a public right. If we were all as compassionate as we would like to think we are, wouldn't we be doing something on the political level to make that happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, there does seem to be a whole long list of problems here in the United States and around the world concerning corporations, Bush policies, and the environment. There's a whole world is having problems with these, and isn't it a matter of they're just being short-term, selfishly motivated, then rather than looking out for the communities? I mean, corporations they've got virtual slaves around the world working in sweatshops, and they're selling tennis shoes that cost $5 to make and for $150, and marketing towards kids who probably can't afford anywhere near that kind of money for a tennis shoe. This is typical American corporate greed, isn't it? And isn't this going to reflect on our country and ultimately back on us? Aren't we going to pay for this in some fashion or another?
That's the whole fair trade versus free trade issue.
Yeah.
And one thing we do in our church, for example, is we buy fair trade coffee, not off-the-shelf coffee.
But if it's a matter of long-term heaven or hell or karma or something, or just opening the way to enlightenment, I think there are some positive benefits for looking out for the community. And short-term drawbacks of just short-term egotistical looking out for yourself has got to have some major drawbacks. Any ideas on what those might be?
Ask that again. Are you asking whether...
Well, what the short term, if you're going to behave in an egotistical fashion, just looking out for yourself in the short term at the expense of everyone else...
Are there drawbacks to living that
way?
Yeah,
what would those be? Shay, do you have any ideas on that?
You know, it's funny. You talk about what are the personal ramifications of being selfish.
Exactly.
Isn't that in itself a selfish question?
Well, certainly. I'm concerned.
how will
All right. What's it going to cost me?
how will it affect me? What's it going to take out of me if I put bad stuff out there? And again, I think this is a perfect time to try to, Jim, you were trying to phase us towards speaking about from the private and then towards the universal. What's the whole goal of being selfless? Why are we trying to become more transcendent, more spiritual, more more universally minded, rather than giving in to our most basic needs and our most
animalistic
survival mechanisms? So, why give it up? Because the society runs smoother? Yeah, it does, but maybe not for you. Because it's the right thing? Yeah, but maybe doing the right thing hurts sometimes. So, again, what's the motivation? Harry Prakash used the word motivation. What are we doing it for? And the answer is, again, the sublimation of my ego is not a personal pursuit for my own development. This is not self-help. This is God created a world, and he created the world with a plan. He's a designer, and he designed the world for a function. That perfected function, when the world is actually operating as it's intended to operate in a perfect way, and you might popularly refer to as utopia, or as what we would refer to as the messianic era. That is the motivation. Why do I do good? Not because of me. Because the Creator willed to make a world because he had a plan in mind. And I want to be part of the plan. I want the world to function in its full beauty, the most full expression of its purpose. I want things, objects, relationships, people, places, governments, to express God's will. And so I'm giving up myself because I sense something, a desire greater than my personal desires, and that is the godly desire. God desires a beautiful world. God desires a utopia, a messianic world. And in my small way, if I stop focusing on my own attainments, I can have a role in giving God what he wants, not with giving me what I want, or even doing what's right, or even doing what's convenient, or what's best for the welfare of society at large. I'll tell you quickly a story. In the very beginning years of the Hasidic movement, there was a charge by the Tsarist government against the first Rebbe of Chabad, Chabad being a particular intellectual branch of Hasidism, because this branch emphasized the Judaic virtue of self-abnegation. The followers, the disciples of this particular group, were really trained rigorously in becoming selfless and really looking at being sensitive to God, thinking, what does God want? What does God need? How can I give up my desires to do God's desire? To the point of becoming very, very selfless people without material concerns, without all the animalistic drives that are so basic to our nature. So the Tsarist government charged these people are going to become leeches. They're going to drain society because they won't contribute, because they're totally... like we say in English, a Luftmensch, a man who lives in the air. He's not grounded. He doesn't want basic attainment.
Uh-huh.
So the Rebbe, the leader of his flock, answered the charge as follows: who contributes most to the welfare of all humankind? The one who is self-interested and greedy, and can only see as far as his own pocketbook, his own bedroom, his own plate? Or is it the selfless person who's not motivated by ego? That is the person who makes the true contribution. That is the person who wants not himself to be gratified, but he wants the world. He wants the world to be perfect so that God may be gratified. The world may become a perfect place.
All right,
that
thank you.
That is truly the most pure
thank
motivation.
You, thank you, Shay. We're just about out of time here. This is an example. I think it's fascinating how everybody got together and this just took on a life of its own. We didn't necessarily go anywhere near what I was saying before. But I've got a conclusion here that I've written up, and I think we'll probably agree on it anyway. So I'm going to read it since I wrote it. I tried several times to write a conclusion that did not sound patronizing, pretentious, or preachy, but I really couldn't do it. So I'll just run it down as a checklist. One, values or preferences... as preferences are everyone's choice. Values as principles are universal. If you choose to ignore universal human principles and are miserable, you deserve it. If you're honorable and yet constantly seeking fortune and fame and are miserable, grow up. Find something larger than yourself and your ego to work for. There seems to be natural processes in effect that are real as gravity, but much more ethereal. Mature happiness can be elusive and found indirectly. Feeding the ego does not build self-respect. Treat the world as you treat your children and earn a little sense of self-worth. I'd like to thank everybody for being here tonight. This has been a wonderful conversation. We have Reverend Dr. Charles Wolfe from the Congregational Church in Madison, Robert Park, Humanist Union of Madison, Amim Salih Urshan from the Dawah Circle Muslim Mosque here in Madison. And on the phone is Rabbi Shay Taub Lubavitch of Wisconsin, and also my friend, Reverend Prakash Shakti from Integral Yoga Institute in Buckingham.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You got a lot of fun.
Well, we did another hour or two.